You like construct a series of pages, and then that exists as this like fictional object, and you can revisit it and like practice it anew, and you know what you want to say, but you also start saying something, and then you try again and you do it better, and you try again and you do it better.
Hi everyone, welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And listeners, today, I have one simple question for you. A question, if we're being honest, that I've been wondering about for a long time, and one that perhaps we will finally get to the bottom of during today's episode, which features the incomparable, the hugely talented, the human gem that is Madeline McDonnell. Madeline McDonnell is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she was an Iowa Arts Fellow, and the author of three incredible books, the story collection There's Something Inside It Wants to Get Out, the novella Penny N, and a debut novel, The Lonesome Ballroom. Madeline has taught creative writing and literature courses at colleges and universities across the country, most recently in the MFA program at Portland State. McDonnell's work has been called fearless, gorgeous, weird, and a favorite of mine, a bejeweled hand grenade and tour de force. I agree with all of this, but let's get back to my question. Like many people, I remember when I was a young writer and my head caught fire. I'll never forget the feeling of holding a particular fiction workshop packet I smuggled from the white wooden shelves of Dye House, gathering the pages in my arms, and starting to read a piece by a writer whose voice brought hot a new vision of what was possible on the page. A voice absolutely smoking with humor and wit and heart, so much heart that I wasn't entirely sure this writer could be existing on the same plane that I was. This writer was deft and worldly and gilded in some knowing way I hadn't come across before. There were the arcs and tropes so many of us were told we could no longer make new. Parents and lovers, seasons and nature, and music and interior strife, but also, gasp, joy. Actually being made new in such new and newly exciting ways that, as mentioned, my head caught fire and I stood there shivering in my pajamas and watched my world go up in flames in the best way imaginable. And when it was all over, when I had put the pages down and surveyed the raised earth at my feet, I said to myself, I asked myself this question, is that all there is to a fire? I mean, really, is that all there is? Because if that's all there is, I said to myself, then we should keep creating. Because Madeline McDonnell, this new writer I had just read, had shown me a way I hadn't yet put together. One simple, fundamental truth. The pursuit of art and artistic vision isn't in capitulating or in the safety of an avenue paved and laid bare. It's in the mess, the heat, the willingness to strike your own match, to light your own way, and trust that the reader won't be afraid to crackle and spark with you. It's a lesson I've been learning from Madeline McDonnell since 2004. And 20 plus years later, I can finally say yes. That is all there is. Madeline McDonnell is all there is to writing. And if we're lucky to be in her fiery landscape of arts and letters, we should all find that joy. It is a luxury to be able to welcome today to Sad Me of the Past, the singular Madeline McDonnell.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Welcome to the pod, Madeline.
Hey,
what Danny
thank
said.
You guys for
what
having
Danny said.
Me. Yeah. You know, Danny, you don't want to be on this plane.
I do. I want to be on it. We all want to be on it.
I think actually I'm kind of about like the slow, like long plot arc. You know, you think there's no plot, but I put those pages there 20 years ago with a vision of this moment. And I have a box of matches right here. I'm about to actually just light myself on fire, motherfuckers.
Let's do it. We'll just watch at the end. Let's do it at the end because we do need the content. So
yeah.
Oh, all right. All right.
We can't let you go yet.
You're such a mercenary.
We can't let you go yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, I want to record the podcast, guys.
Yeah.
Before the fire. Before the self-immolation.
Well, it's so great to see you, Madeline. And you know, I mean, we can sort of just go sort of straight to the chase if you want. We can go straight to the big fire.
I don't see why we would do that.
More bantering first? Or we can banter.
I think we should definitely banter. I mean, it's really up to you guys. I'll follow your lead.
Madeline, remember how we were both born in Virginia a few days apart?
Yes. Well, no. Have you guys seen The Twins? It's like a fine.
Ooh. Yes.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger?
So Yeah. So the conceit is like these two twins are born, you know, a very short interval apart, as, you know, bodies must be separate, which is, you know, we go to literature to solve this.
That's the base of shame, too.
Yes. So in the movie, there was like a scientific experiment. I can't remember the science of it, but these twins were kind of manipulated prior to their birth, where all the excellent genes were channeled into one of the twin. That's to Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then Danny DeVito is like the other twin. Mm. And then they're separated at birth. And what Lauren and I discovered last summer is that I'm DeVito. Mm. And no. We were born a few mere hours apart. Like,
we were already battling
supposedly
for first place among the weirdos.
But I feel like we
share that gold.
Yeah. Well, do you have your matches ready?
I mean, I know how to start a fire with just about anything. I'm ready.
Speaking of starting a fire, at some point in your life, a fire started in you that you wanted to be a writer. And one of the things that we like to do on this podcast is travel back to that time.
Way back in time.
Stephen with sound effects today.
Stephen's getting spicier with each episode.
So we,
I'm here for it.
We like to travel back in time and sort of figure out what got you to this point, what kind of reader and writer and human you were. And so we're going to maybe jump in with a couple questions. We believe that you have something to read to us. From a time in your youth. And so maybe let's start with, can you talk to us a little bit about starting out, like where were you born and raised, and how did like writing and literature kind of function in your world growing up?
She was born in Virginia a few hours before me.
I guess we're done with the show. Thanks so much for joining us, Madeline.
Got that.
Yes, I was born in Virginia, but I was raised in a suburb of Boston. So my parents moved around a little bit when I was very young because my mom was an academic, an English professor who specializes in the works of Geoffrey Chaucer.
So fancy.
Poet like yourselves.
Wow,
yeah.
Now we see where it all comes from.
Wait, did you have to memorize the opening to Canterbury Tales in Middle English?
I did at a certain point, but the thing that stands out to me always about the prologue of the Canterbury Tales is like my mom would, when she was finding me and my siblings annoying and like we were getting up in her space or interrupting her work, she would just start like reciting Chaucer.
You mean reciting?
And speaking to us in this like Middle English
like one that appeared the short of suit
yeah,
the
with the short of suit the drop the root. I can do it all. Yes.
Wow.
This is, I you're causing me to want to flee more than
awesome.
I already.
It's the only thing I have memorized other than like tons of They Might Be Giants lyric.
Yeah, so we, as far as writing, I would say literature was like valued and reading and writing were things my parents were doing a lot of and were thinking about and talking about and encouraging. So I feel like it was always, as soon as I was able to read, I was reading a lot.
Nice.
And identified. It's funny because I think like some of the most vivid memories that I have from childhood are just of reading. So nobody else is in the room, but like I remember when I first learned to read. This time I was reading Frog and Toad, and I was just like,
"Yeah." Do you remember the first time it made sense? Like, do you remember that first?
Yeah, like I remember totally. I remember starting to learn and being told like it will click at some point and being like, no, it won't. And then I remember it happening and just being like, yes.
I remember the first, I remember clearly the first time that the lines like all came together and suddenly I was like, oh, I'm reading.
I think I still, that moment is still in my future.
So Stephen, we'll work on it.
Yeah. No, See Spot Run. I remember See Spot Run, but that was a long time ago.
But do you remember the moment when the lines came together?
No.
Stephen's a little older than
I know. Stephen's a little slow.
It was different back then.
So Madeline, what, like when you were first starting to read, sort of as you, you know, were growing up, like what were you reading? What were some of your favorite things?
You know, I was just reading like all sorts of things. I mean, I definitely remember, I've thought about this a little because I have kids of my own now and I've revisited some of the things that I read when I was young. But so I definitely read like some of those childhood classics, like Frances Hodgson Burnett, like A Little Princess in the Secret Garden, books like that. And I have this memory, this only happened once, but it came to stand as like the, you know, some sort of mark of like childhood of the mind. But there was a day where I was reading A Little Princess, and this is back when kids like roamed freer than they do now, and I like got on my bike and biked over to the local elementary school, and it was like a beautiful spring day, and I had an apple, not that I like ate wholesome food all the time, but I had brought this like wholesome apple and this wholesome work of literature from the past, and I climbed this crab apple tree and I sat among the boughs with like the blossoms opening around me, and I just like read for hours, and always like remembered the pleasure of that. And I told my daughter about that, so she has like tried to recreate that scene a bunch of times in our yard, like, you know, being like, do we have any apples? So that I read books like that, but I also read like all the Babysitter's Club books, and like all the books. I feel like I remember like when we were kids, these like Dell paperbacks that would have like a cartoon on the cover, like The Cat Ate My Gym Suit, and like, and like little, like these sort of pop novels for like 8 to 11 year olds. Like I was really into those, and there were like a family vacation. We'd like find the town bookstore, and my mom and I would like go there every day and buy like a book each day.
Did you ever read like scary books like Goosebumps or like...
I remember those. I did not read those because I was not into being scared.
No, same.
I was full of fear, but I wasn't seeking it out.
They were creepy. I mean, I reread one recently and I was like, this is scary. Like, this is psychologically damaging. Like, we're not talking about monsters. Like, these stories are about you haven't yet developed a sense of self, and these stories are basically like tearing it down. So,
well, it's interesting if just to think about that for a second, Lauren, talking about like being scared or being surprised or being taken into a new space. I mean, that's what reading is able to do for us, right? It's to push us in new directions. So, you're talking about like sitting in a crabapple tree and reading a lot. Do you remember when you started to write your own stories or poems or whatever it is? Because it's always interesting to me when writers move from that kind of passion and interest in reading into also creating for themselves and writing for themselves.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that since you invited me into this, you know, illustrious meeting of the mind. Because I feel like I thought of myself as someone who liked to write, but it's hard for me to recall if I was actually doing a lot of writing. Like I did some in school, and my elementary school had like a literary magazine that they would put out every year that I vividly remember. Like we'd all sign the cover and draw little pictures in it. And so there were, you know, the kinds of little creative exercises you might do in a classroom, I always enjoyed. And when I was in third grade, I had some very passionate aspirations to, you know, make it big on the stage. Musical theater. I mean, with charisma, like I have, it was just
it's true.
There wasn't material there for me, so I had to create my own. So I wrote this play called like The Haunted Halloween, I would work on it during recess with some other kids, and we ended up, the school helped us like mount the play.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was like off, and we tried to get, oh, go ahead, Stephen.
No, I was just going to say, how'd the performance go?
It was fine. You know, I played like a comedic relief, like jack-o'-lantern character who was like secretly evil. I still remember the voice that I would have to do. I remember I had like a crush on this other kid in the class, and I kept trying to cast him, but he wanted to like trade baseball cards on the playground during recess. And I remember there was this one recess where I was like, if you don't come to rehearsal, you're out. And he was like over with his friends. And then we all yelled, like we yelled a countdown, like 10, 9, 8, like for him to come over and be in the play.
Where's he now? Oh. What is he doing now? Nothing.
I'm sure he's in sales.
All right. Yeah, awesome.
He's not in the theater, that's for sure.
And no, Madeline, dramatic countdowns to make big life choices have never come up in your life again at any other time, have they?
You'll see that I've learned a lot from this exercise that you guys have.
What, Madeline, you said a second ago that you remember the voice of the jack-o'-lantern.
Yeah, can we hear the voice?
Let's do it.
Oh, it was like, ah!
That's scary enough right there. I'm starting to see why this boy didn't want to get involved. Yeah, it might have been a little scary.
He was making life choices.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, that play also featured world famous celebrity Mindy Kaling, who I went to elementary school with.
What?
She had kind of a side
lead with
role.
That.
Yeah.
Nice.
What?
Yeah, no. She gets enough attention, Lauren.
Right. No, but
my podcast.
Yes.
No, can we let's get in touch and let's get this thing on the stage. I mean, if she was in it once, she could probably bring it to some producers.
It's a series.
Yeah, she has power. She has power. She could bring it back.
I like that.
Instead, she just lets me wither in this closet.
I like that you describe the play in elementary school as fine. I think that's, I'm just going to say that might be the most precise way to describe all elementary school plays.
So Madeline, when did you, so you're not sure when you started writing, like after that, where did your writing sort of go after the play?
Yeah,
like,
you know, after that, I think, so I always had journals and I would start things, like I'd have little, like, we actually, shout out to my brother who looked for all of these things from across the country over the weekend. He did find some of my earlier works, not that I'm not going to explore today, but there was like a journal that had, it was like furniture stories, chapter one, like the, really? From the perspective of my desk and from the perspective, but then you go to the actual page numbers and there's just like three lines.
Oh.
But I had some plan to write this series that would be narrated by all my furniture.
Well, like the table of contents and titles, like the table of contents, my kid, there's so many notebooks with just an intense table of contents and then nothing. I love that the table of contents is like, oh, I'm done.
The planning. The planning's the fun part.
Yeah.
The writing's the hard part.
I was thinking though, like, I think one of the works that I found in there was I had started this like chapter book that was some kind of mystery. And it was clearly like heavily influenced by the voice of the Nancy Drew mysteries, which are really retrograde and just like fucked.
Really?
It's like tall, attractive 16-year-old Nancy. You know, like Sline was like tall, attractive Patty O'Donnell.
It's always Patty.
Yeah.
Did you know that she's a graduate of the University of Iowa? Mildred Wirt Benson.
I had no idea.
Man, I didn't know that.
She graduated from the University of Iowa and she wrote under Carolyn
Keene.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so we have in the library archives, like a bunch of Nancy Drew, like early work.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's incredible.
Amazing.
So Madeline, you're clearly reading books like Nancy Drew at the time. You're starting to write. And so you mentioned earlier, like having this idea in your head that you were always a writer, but you weren't like finishing a bunch of things or, you know, was there whether it was a practice or whether it was like a place in your house, where were you doing your writing? Or do you remember if you were kind of participating in the act of writing frequently, or is it just something you did like only in school and that was it?
I think it was there was a little bit of that like home space. You guys can see me right now, and I am in a closet. That wasn't a metaphor. I'm like moving into this bedroom closet as an office right now. And when I was a kid, I've always loved to be in like enclosed spaces that are dark where I can kind of shut out the rest of the world, especially when I'm trying to write or think in a different way. And I do remember in my house that I grew up in until I was 12, I fashioned this little like office for myself in the closet where there was like an old bureau, and I overturned one of the drawers and like put some kind of board in it to make a desk. And I would sit on the floor and like close the door. It was a very small closet. It was like super dark. And I remember I worked on this report about the printing press in there that I was rapidly working on. And I was so proud of it when I emerged. And then when we moved out of that house, like I felt this special attachment to the closet. And I was really upset that somebody else would have that closet. So I wrote my name in cursive in the corner at the very bottom. And then many years later, like when I was in my 20s, that house was for sale again. And my family went to the open house and I was visiting. And so I went into the closet immediately, like raced up there. And my name was still there. And a bunch of other kids had written their names above it. Yeah.
And they're all.
That's a canon event right there.
And they're all writers now. That was a magic closet.
They're all cursed.
Yeah.
You're the only one left.
So
it would be like a book called The Corner Kids. And if you wrote your name there, you are cursed.
Would it be a Goosebumps?
It would be absolutely an R.L. Stine Goosebumps.
Do you remember anything else that you wrote in there, or did you go on to write in other closets and other houses?
Well, I definitely wrote my Nancy Drew rep off like in that vicinity of that closet for sure. And I remember my dad like coming in and being like, oh, are you writing a novel? And he was like really pleased sounding. My parents were very encouraging. So it's their fault.
It always
is. But yeah.
So Madeline, so maybe you can tell us like how from this point, maybe you can take us sort of up to what you're going to read today. Is what you're going to read today something from around that period, or is it like, or do we have ways to go when you
read this? I decided to read something a little later. It was interesting. I was looking at the Nancy Drew ripoff, and at first I was like, oh, this will be great. And then it actually, that sad me of the past was just like too sad.
Too sad,
Because, just that age, like I think I was around like 10 or 11, which is the same age as one of my kids. And I feel like you're just starting to feel so much more social pressure to like perform your identity at that time in like new and insidious, cruel ways. And so just looking back at the way Patty O'Donnell was characterized, like this is my alter ego in the book. She was like really into sports and just like all the stuff that wasn't true, but I was trying to like produce this version of myself on the page that was like who I wanted to be perceived as. And it was just like crushing. I was thinking too about like, you know, what I think of now as why literature is so essential to my existence and why I have like centered it in my life. And I feel like the answer I'm usually giving myself now is like the way that it is. Writing is both, it has this intense sociality while utterly rejecting social language. You know, it's like trying to find what more complicated experience or secret heat is existing and running under these social performances that we all engage in with each other, trying to like connect our separateness, but not being able to fully. And so there was a way like reading that old work, I was just like, that's antithetical to literature's project.
Heresy.
This is offensive to me. Yes, heresy. But then I was thinking about too, like, I think part of what was drawing me to this Nancy Drew ripoff was just, it was still like, there was partially the same thing going on where I loved the feeling of having like somebody else's logic or voice in my mind. And as a reader, reading a lot all through my life, like I just always, I have that memory of being a kid and closing a book and still hearing the sounds of the words and starting to have my thoughts follow a sonic pattern. And so I just wanted to keep having that feeling, which I think has that same desire at its heart. But the way that the work was coming out Even calling it the work is just like,
oh, it's the work.
Should we all just like throw up together? Yeah, it was, it was sad. You guys have like messed with me this week. I'm like,
nailed it, huh?
The sad me of the past was so sad. And my present self is like so sad to have that sad me. And I'm like so sad about future me that is just going to have to drag around. Not like, not only that me, but like this me and the one I'm about to introduce you to, which is high school me.
High school.
I mean, this is like shadow work. Like we're doing real live. Like we're your therapists today.
So do you feel? So do you feel as you were moving forward, maybe towards this piece? Mm-hmm. Were you? Did you feel like your writing began to get more sort of authentic or sort of revealing of your true self? Like, were you conscious then that this was something that you wanted to do? Like, be more honest in what you were writing, or did it just kind of naturally happen?
I don't think so. I don't think I was thinking about it that way at that point at all. But I was just, I liked the, having the sound of another voice in my head. And I kept trying to do that sporadically. And I think most of the writing would happen for school. Especially as like school became more intense and I was busy with it more. The work that I'm going to read
it's
to
work.
You today.
You worked on it.
It came to mind in part because I wrote it at like a summer camp. So it was kind of like the Young Writer Studio, a version of that where I was taking a fiction workshop. And I think, you know, in part because I was starting these things, as I've told you guys, all through my life, but not really like having the energy or will to follow them through and just kind of playing around. And I think this is really the first story I ever wrote in my entire life that had like a beginning, a middle, and an end that like went all the way through. And my brother, he texted me these PDFs. It's like handwritten.
Amazing.
And, you know, we were writing it out in notebooks like at this camp. And we didn't have like computer access or anything like that.
Do you
like
remember
the kids these days?
Yeah. Do you remember the camp, Madeline? What was the camp like?
Well, it was CTY. So Center for Talented Youth. Yeah. Which actually Nick taught at it for several summers.
So were you in Baltimore? Like, where did that happen?
They had campuses all over the country. So I started going to this in seventh grade, and there was a campus at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. But then I took the prereqs to take the creative writing classes that they had later on. And but they only taught creative writing at this one campus in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So that is where I was when I wrote this. And I took a playwriting class there and a fiction class. My brother couldn't, it might've been amazing if he could have like gotten a PDF of the play. Cause it was, all we read was David Mamet. And it was this play about these three kids they're like young adults in a music conservatory studying classical music, which I knew nothing about. But I remember like, they're all just like, fuck Puccini, the fucking, you know, it's just like,
yes,
just like,
I can use
like
every
Dave, like hard boiled, like David Mamet, like angry language.
Mm. Like, you're sitting there just like biting your apple being like, yes.
Damn arias. Yeah, yeah, you should come back on, Madeline. We'll do it. We'll do another episode.
Oh, the sequel.
The play,
yeah.
If you find
yeah.
it. Yeah.
We'll okay. stay. We'll do a stage reading of that play.
We'll get Mindy back.
Yes,
we'll
get
Mindy. You know,
get that boy. Let's get that boy wherever he is.
So, Madeline, so you're before you read this piece, just one other question. So, sure. when in high school was this?
I knew you'd do this to me, Danny. So I contemplated before this, I was like, should I lie? Should I say I was 13?
No.
Should I say I was 12? Because I don't know. I feel like this is excusable for like a 13-year-old.
No.
But for the age I actually was, so it was the summer after sophomore year of high school.
Yeah.
Okay. No, and unfortunately, since Lauren and I are twins who were genetically engineered for Lauren to get all the non-abject parts, she knows that the summer after sophomore year, we had turned 16. But I want to say and make very clear.
But we were a young 16.
I was like
we were practically 14.
You don't,
I was like a week into being 16.
I think we really seriously. I think we really have to discourage any kind of apologizing for your the work of your youth because, you know, honestly, everyone's on their own
you
track.
You say that now.
We're on your
now,
own track.
Stephen.
I mean,
and we're not.
We haven't done my episode yet, Madeline. So you know, yeah. Trust me.
I know. I'm waiting for
trust
that.
Trust me.
We're not. Yeah, so I was. Really let's well. Say I was on the cusp all of right. 15, yeah. 16. Yeah, okay. I was a 15, 16 cusp.
What was happening in the world the summer of our sophomore year? I can't remember.
It was 1995.
So AOL. Did it come on a CD? Not yet.
I don't think we had AOL. I didn't have AOL yet. I remember that being like senior year that
yeah.
I got AOL. It might have existed, but I didn't.
You might have had Prodigy.
I don't know if there was internet.
My yeah. older brother did like some early internet stuff. I remember there was like a black screen with like green letters flashing.
Yeah, and MS-DOS.
Some
yeah.
kind of dial-up thing.
So were you writing on a computer?
I would
oh, wait,
do
no,
that
this
for
is handwritten.
School. Yeah, but this is all handwritten. Like I wrote this out in a notebook. And then one of the reasons I thought of this, I was like, we probably still have it somewhere at my parents' house because we had to make like 25 copies. And I remember I brought them all home. So actually there's like a stack of like workshopped copies. And it says at the top, to the people who read this story, I apologize. The author.
Oh, no. Wow. You're apologizing.
I mean, also, men. But like, I could see that
oh,
carrying
yeah.
through to
was,
now. Lead with
I mean,
the apology.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I used to write like that exact thing on my workshop stories, those ones that set your soul on fire, Danny.
Oh.
Everyone's always saying don't apologize, but I'm like, maybe we should all be like apologizing
more.
Yeah. Actually, we should go the
like,
other
way. There's this truism. It's like, come on, people. This is a fucked up situation we're all in. Like,
if we're not doing well.
If this were like yeah. held at a higher value in our culture, maybe, you know.
In the absence of apologizing, let's hear this story.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
I can read it.
You don't have to read the whole thing. It's totally up to you. Whatever you want to read, and we can edit
I
or
don't
cut
think
whatever you
I
want.
Can read the whole thing is actually 39 handwritten pages. It's pretty
oh
long.
Okay, now yeah. I get the apology.
I mean, no, that's even more why you should never apologize. You wrote a 39-page
yeah,
story.
I appreciate it.
That summer, in sitting in the bow of a tree somewhere with your apple.
I was probably like on the floor of some classroom, like yeah. in a corner, like scribbling yeah. away with other kids around me. So that's
well,
what
yeah.
I was doing. Okay.
Yeah, let's hear
so
it.
I'll just read. I mean, feel free to stop me. I'm not sure how long.
Let's we usually do like 2 to 5 minutes. I don't know,
just
but
okay.
I'll stop you when I start getting bored. How about that?
All right, perfect.
All right, cool.
Okay. All right. This story is called Reflection.
Yes, it is.
Wait, singular?
Indeed, it is.
Singular. Okay. Are you ready? I don't think you are. Reflection. I do love him. I've always loved him. From the day I saw him walk into that dark Boston bar to now. Now when he's gone and I'm left only with a stranger's letters. The bar was called South Pacific. It's so strange to think of the beginning here now at the end. To think of that ugly bar with smoky hot air and red paper lanterns hanging from the ceilings. The thick fruit-filled drinks served in mock coconut glasses with tiny paper umbrellas. Frothy white drinks in tall, curvy glasses with striped straws. Maraschino cherries pierced with bright plastic swords.
Dude, this is good.
Wait a minute. I just have to jump in here. This is friggin' incredible, man. Are you kidding me?
What are you talking about?
Wait.
What?
Are you sure this is something you wrote when you were 16? Even for you,
barely
this
16.
Is extraordinary. This is Gabriel okay. Garcia Marquez writing when you... Go ahead. We had to have that moment
it,
of amazement.
It continues.
Right,
it
continue.
Continues.
I hope it, right, get,
you,
I hope it
ready?
Gets worse. Honestly.
I was a waitress. I brought drinks to businessmen and couples on a straw tray. My uniform was a tight red silk dress embroidered with tiny palm trees. I shoved my tips into my bra. The dress had no pockets. I didn't like being a waitress. I didn't like the dirty clutter of people. I didn't like the hot air heavy with cigar ash and pineapple. I didn't like the thick drinks saturated with alcohol and ice. I wanted to be a poet and hid in the bar's bathroom. Scrawling mournful villanelles and sonnets onto paper napkins with a ballpoint pen. Richard came into the bar one night with clients. I noticed
Richard.
Him. because he looked unhappy. Yeah, Richard's like a fiction name to me. It's like Henry or Richard.
He has a beard, I bet.
He looks unhappy. Oh,
yeah. That was how you described him.
Yes. We know that. That's why our narrator noticed him. His eyes were watery, not like he'd been crying, but blue and pale and wet. His lips were thin, and when he smiled, they barely moved. It seemed that if he stretched them too far, they would break. He was squinting, despite the darkness. He stayed at South Pacific for 3 hours, poring over his papers and sipping his beer. I got off at 11. I had never been to a bar.
You'd never know. All right.
Well, when did you start the shift? I mean, it's reasonable. If you open, then yeah.
That's true. You could get off at 11. Right. I got off at 11 and went to the parking lot behind the bar. It was January and dirty snow formed a thick rim around the lot. I rubbed my arms. My coat had worn thin and watched my breath crystallize in the air. I was waiting for him. I didn't know if he would even come out the back, but I stood in the snow rubbing my arms and I waited. He just seemed so sad. And he was one of the only people to order a beer the whole night, a tall gold beer in a glass, no cherry. And I just wanted to get out of that bar, away from the coconuts and salty heat. I wanted to be saved. I wanted to save someone else. I don't know how long I waited before he came outside, but I ran up to him and told him I had no way of getting home, that I was cold, and I didn't want to walk to the bus station. Maybe we could have a cup of coffee. He said I did look cold in my dress and led me to his car, a white 1960 T-Bird. He wasn't even surprised. He took me back to his apartment and showed me his kitchen. He showed me his green metal refrigerator and told me it was there when he bought the apartment. He kept running his fingers through his hair and looking around, opening and closing cupboards and brushing dust off the green countertops. He told me that he didn't spend much time here, that he sold real estate. It was what his father had done. Well, his father had been a salesman. He had sold cars, and somehow Richard had ended up selling things too, selling land. His eyes were wide, and he kept shrugging, lifting his palms up as if he didn't know how he had ended up this way. That was the night he told me his mother had died, that first night. Really, I asked him about her. I said, "What about your mother? What does she do?" And he told me she was dead. She had died when he was young. Sorry. He was getting coffee beans from the freezer, and his back was to me. I tried to read his back to see if the loss was still painful. Maybe his shoulders would tense up, but he was still. He's always been so still and quiet and alone. I was with him, but he still seemed so lonely, and I wanted to touch him, to hold him. He asked if I'd be needing any more rides home. I nodded. So he came the next night and the next and waited for me in the back in his white Thunderbird. At first, he would always be silent. And after we had been driving through darkness for a few minutes and were dangerously close to the small Cambridge apartment where I lived, I'd mention the prospect of a beer and we'd turn and head to his apartment. Each glass, though, would lead to more and more talk, and we'd swallow the beer and spit out words, and what we said would lie before us and we'd look at it. Should I keep going?
Like, this is ridiculous. Let's how pause. Good it is. Yeah. I'm a little pissed. We should get, where are those elementary school writing? Like, oh my God. This is really good, right, guys?
Oh my God. It's ridiculous.
Okay, Madeline.
Yeah.
A couple things. Yeah. One, what?
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 How okay. did you know how, like, a mid-20s relationship yeah. worked?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what? Well,
have you like dated at this point? I mean, how did you know?
Okay, well, at this point, I was in my first relationship, if you can say, like, if that's the right phrase, at the time. Like, I had my first boyfriend sophomore year.
Was he a salesman?
He was nothing like Richard.
Not even sad eyes?
No. He hadn't lived long enough. Not particularly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was... The thing that I recognized, like, when I read this back over, I mean, it gets really ridiculous. So I can read some more parts of it if you want me to later on. but he was like a senior at our high school, so he was older than I was, and he was also like we were like theater kids together, and he was very theatrical and extroverted, and like a comedian who was just always like, you know, cracking jokes and like doing impressions. And
so he's
like
Richard.
So you longed for the quiet, sad boy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, perhaps. and he also, there was a way like this. I think what I was pouring into this a little bit, and maybe it becomes clearer as the story goes on, but like was just this, these two people that are in a relationship, but not really like communicating very much. And I think I felt in that relationship like I was very fixated on it, but my ability to like be a full presence in it was somewhat limited as like a 15-year-old like sidekick younger girl to this like joke cracking Sebado concert going.
Sebado, wow, deep drop.
But it's
he went to a lot. He was
It's just so fascinating, Madeline. We did another episode recently with a wonderful writer, Josh Parkinson. And we were talking with him about the piece he read where he had been 15 when he wrote his piece. And it's so focused on like plot. It's just like action, action, action. Yeah. And the thing that's really fascinating to me, it's not surprising because I've always believed you were a genius. But when you start this conversation and say like, oh, this is so terrible, and then you start reading and I realize like I couldn't write that story that you are reading right now. I couldn't write it today.
Nope.
And I'm well into my mid-40s.
He's a really good writer.
And I'm a great writer.
Yeah.
I just am so impressed with, at that age, your knowledge. And it's actually, you do the same thing, Madeline, in your new novel. The opening scene... It's not just about the bar. It's the opening scene in your novel and in this story is someone saying, boy, if only I could tell you all this other stuff because I know what's going to happen, but I'm not going to tell you what happened now. I'm just going to start at the beginning. You're dropping these threads and then you're pulling the reader back and we're constantly going, instead of action, 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 driving plot, driving plot, driving plot, you're pushing me via the character to start thinking about investing in this time because I want to hear it from the character's point of view. And I just, how did you know how to do any of this?
I mean, well, thank you for being so kind toward my sad me of the past.
We're sorry.
Oh, sad. Whatever, really... Madeline.
We're sorry.
Don't try to play sad with us.
It's true, Danny. Like I was really, I remembered that I had written this story and that like it was the first big story I wrote all the way through and that we had these copies of it. And I remembered later on, they spend a lot of time in this very like white apartment. And there are many descriptions of just the white walls and the white sheets and the white this and the white that, and this empty barren space. But I had completely forgotten that it started at a bar.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Why? How? Like at that point in my life, I had like never entered a bar, nor did I don't think I really had any intention. I didn't know about the things that were to come and all the times I would spend, the hours I would log at the greatest institution in America.
Totally nailed it. Yeah.
And so at that part, I was just like, why did I have that conception of that as this like fictional space? And then also the fact that it was like a tiki bar, like, so there's Lonesome Ballroom, there's a bar there. And then Penny, like that, the novella that Danny referred to earlier, like has a whole sequence at a tiki bar. And then it has like all these things in common with this story too. And I was also thinking about like another story I wrote. So after I wrote this, I came home from camp and I showed it to my mom and she read it. And as you guys already know,
oh my God, I would be so worried.
She's not one to like conceal her true reaction to a work of literature, as my dad can attest.
Did she start speaking in tongues in Middle English?
She was like, the tospek of woe that is in Mariaja. That would be the right line.
Yeah, what did she say? What did she say, Madeline?
Well, she read it, and I was like, "What do you think?" And she was like, "It's just funny when younger people write about, you know, adult experiences.
Your mom is wrong. No. It was so good.
Do you think she was, so looking back, do you think that she was a little nervous about the subject matter? Do you think she was just kind of like, I can't really engage with this because I'm, you know, you don't
no,
really have
No, I think
a,
she was
a...
like, and it's like, you guys should hear some of the rest of it because it gets really ridiculous.
I don't believe you.
I jump in and ask an important question? Did you have the moxie at that age to write like a makeout scene?
Well, there's like some parts where she like pulls him onto the bed, but then it cuts away.
Nice.
So there's Yeah.
Smart.
You learned that from Nancy Drew, probably.
Yeah.
Cut away.
Yeah. I don't think my mom was like scandalized at all. I think she was just like, I think she was giving it like a fair critique.
Did your dad?
Oh, no. My dad would have been just, he would have like, the immolation would have happened.
The moment you started reading it, I would say within two or three sentences, I looked at Danny and Lauren and our minds were kind of blown. I mean, the description is so incredible. If you had told me you had written this when you were 26, I would have completely believed you. I mean, in fact, I was thinking during this whole time, like, were you as good a writer at 16 as you are now? Like how did you, I don't know. I'm just amazed at how good you were that early. I can only imagine it's some incredible.
I'm also like, having heard this, I will never show any of my work to your mom.
No, because she doesn't get it. I mean, we got it so fast.
That's harsh.
You know?
And Stephen's right, and Lauren's right too. I mean, it's just the detail in the description, especially for someone. And Madeline, you know this. You know, I remember this from working at camp. It's with Stephen at the studio, talking to students in high school who are writers. So many of them don't want do the research, or they don't realize that the research can help them expand their knowledge of what's going on, even though elements of research are more accessible to them. They can go on YouTube and watch a video of someone working at a bar and kind of gather information. But at your age, writing longhand at camp without the internet, having never been in a bar, you describe it so well. I mean, the spearing of the maraschino cherry, even just like the description of the beer.
You must have seen a maraschino cherry somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess I had been in, you know, there was like a restaurant club that my grandparents would go to where we'd all like the kids were allowed in the bar and we got Shirley Temples. I just like hadn't, you know, been in like, and actually, you know what? I think now that I think about it, I remember because I told you guys I was a theater kid. So I had been in this community theater production of The Diary of Anne Frank that year, the year before this.
Yep. Was there a bar in that?
Naturally.
Well, as one does.
But they had the production I played like when all the parts where the diary was read, they had cast like three girls around my age to be readers of the diary later in time. So I was like the reader of the diary from the 70s. And I had this like really this like Missoni-esque outfit on with all these like popping colors. And I was like sitting on this platform and reading Anne Frank's diary. But for the cast party, so which was like many of the people in the production were adults. And we did go to this like tiki bar, which I guess the younger people were allowed into, but it had like flaming drinks. And this experience had like just occurred. So that's probably where I was
like, formative.
Lifting some of that from. Yeah, I was like, whoa, I must spend the rest of my life in a place like this. And then I did. Suck it, Mom.
suck. I mean, Iowa City doesn't have a tiki bar though. Have you guys, I'm just realizing right now, why don't we have a tiki
really
bar?
Be.
So Madeline, I'm just stunned. So can you tell us a little bit, like, when you did this experience leave you excited about writing fiction? Like, obviously you went on to keep writing, but at that moment you come back from camp with this brilliant story, your mom's kind of like, okay, whatever. You know, what did you do? Were you jazzed about writing? Did you keep writing? And like, I mean, here we're talking about your first novel that's come out. I mean, how did you make it all that way? I guess I'm trying to think of what it would have been like to be a 16-year-old with this incredible level of accomplishment, a gift, whatever you want to call it. How did you bring it forward? Like, how did you nourish it or neglect it or whatever?
Well, again, you guys are just like too kind. So thank you for being so tender to my sad past me and my present me. I was excited. Like, I think I was excited to have the fact that it, you know, it was 39 handwritten out pages, and it really, it did begin and have a middle and have an end. And I was excited about having done that and having this like stack. And I did continue to write, but it was, again, it was usually mostly like for school. But that year there was like, I went to this like bread loaf thing for high school students. So I wrote something new for that was like just about a person exactly my age for years. Like after my mom said that, I like wrote about adults. Wow. But it was good. It was fine. So I would mostly do things like that. But then I think it helped there be this sense that it was something that I could, first I had an experience in a workshop at a pretty young age and just like knew that that existed as like a way of studying. And so when I applied to college, I remember, you know, looking at what the writing offerings were and imagining myself like repeating the experience that I had, which I think is what a situation like that is kind of designed to do a little bit. And I definitely thought about that when I was like making decisions about what to do for the future, like seeing like what kinds of programs. And when I went to college, I did like a ton of creative writing coursework and did a lot of writing. And I wrote a thesis with like great professors that worked in the MFA program there. So it all became like more formalized then. And then I became like very serious at that point.
Yeah. And Madeline, when did you know then that this was something you wanted to devote your life to?
Well, the really like completely ridiculous thing that I think about now is that it was like the practical choice, because I would always, like, my whole life, even from being like a kid on, including in college and like right after, I was like really drawn to different artistic realms. And, you know, I had my play, The Haunted Halloween. I was going to be like in musical theater. In college, I was like really into jazz singing. And I was like, thought maybe I would like pursue that professionally. And I was still doing some other theatrical things, like all this very, you know, impractical stuff. And so whenever the subject of what I would do to support myself would come up, like in the back of my mind, I was like, yeah, that stuff's probably going to be too hard, but I can be a writer. Yeah. Like, obviously I can do that. Yeah.
That's so true, because I remember I was also in theater in high school, and I remember my theater teacher, I can clearly remember him being like, just so you know, if you continue with this, there's going to become a point where you can only get a part if you're part of the union. And the only way you can become part of the union is if you've gotten a part. He's like, this is the catch-22 that every actor goes through. And I remember at that moment being like, no.
Yeah.
There's no union to become a writer. Like, nah, it's too much work.
Right.
So it was a practical.
Yeah, and the fact that, I think the fact that it was something that was like built into school a little bit. So I was able to like be like, okay, like when I was in my 20s and I had my first jobs and was unhappy and wanting to like find a way back toward this like more like, wishful part of myself, like building a life around something that I really loved. The thought that I could like, I could envision what an MFA program was and like knew that that was something that a place I could be comfortable. So it felt easier to imagine that as like a practical, like really, you know, safe reality compared to some of the other ideas that I was flirting with. And here I am,
crushing it.
Hitching my life to sad-eyed males. And
I mean, it's amazing to me, Madeline, that, I mean, to me, you're at such a triumphant moment in your life, because, I mean, you have published stories in a novella, but I know that you've been working on this novel for a long time. It's just been published. I've read a page. I got the novel today. It's like brilliant. It's amazing. It just seems like a huge achievement. I think you should be so proud of yourself and excited for. And I'm curious, like, what you would say to someone who's young and 16, and who does have sort of a gift or has reached some level of accomplishment. Like, what would you tell them about how to carry that sort of into adult life and say, you know, in the, especially when it involves writing a long piece, like a novel or a collection of stories?
Well, first of all, the advice that everyone does and should give, I would just advise them to like read some more and then some more, especially when you're younger and you're able to like have that independent space. And like have, you know, the ability, ideally, not everyone has it, but to like form little quiet pockets around yourself and go into a closet and not be disturbed, which becomes harder as you get older. I would advise that. And you know, to recognize that that work is writing, because as I was telling you guys, you know, this is the first story I ever had written, the beginning, middle, and end, but I was always hearing those voices in my head from years and years and years before. And so even now I feel like I need to remind myself all the time, like when I'm not producing writing, and there will be long stretches where I'm not able to for whatever reason, that the work that I'm doing internally, reading and thinking about it, is going to amount to something later and will make the actual writing operate differently than it would have if I hadn't been doing that work. And, you know, I think I might say this, and I'm not 100% confident in it, but looking back at this story, thinking about its connection to my later work, I don't know. I distrust advice like trust yourself or, you know, believe or whatever. It just seems like facile and, you know, not correct. Something about this, like the story goes on and like she hangs out in this parking lot and like a few different times and then like keeps getting driven over to this guy's house. And then there's one day where she just falls asleep and like sleeps there until the next night. And then she just stays there forever and she quits her job. And she's just like in this apartment, like all alone, like scrawling poems, just like never talking to anyone, like totally abject and dependent. And he's like off at work all the time, but he brings her these bright, tulips every day and like them one by one into a vase. And like at a certain point, she's like, I hate these bright tulips. Get them away from me. Like, I want you. And like pulls him onto the bed and like breathes him in. And then like he goes off and she's alone again, alone, alone, alone. And then she starts writing letters and sending them to all these, you know, like people from her past and people she doesn't know that well because she can't talk to him. And then he discovers the letters and like is all upset, but doesn't really express why. And they have this kind of confrontation at the end. And the very last image, she's like washing out a cup of coffee and she's looking into the coffee and she like turns the water on and the coffee, like her reflection from the title, like, you know, breaks up into a million pieces or whatever. So the thing that there was a thing that like really depressed me about revisiting this, which was just like the intense interest in the like hyper feminine abjection, which obviously runs through all my work, that it was there already, like before I'd really had like the horrible relationships that were to come, and like the utter abjection in my life that I would like descend into hadn't even occurred, but it somehow I like knew that that was that sort of logic was accessible to me. And so that was interesting to me, but also just like unsettling. And then there was another thing that surprised me too, which was just actually, it was pretty well structured, but strangely structured. You were saying, Danny, how there it's like pretty interior. Mm-hmm. And something that I was noticing, so it starts in the bar and there's like all these, you know, the colors and the smoke and whatever. And then they go to his green apartment and then they buy this other apartment that's the white apartment where they are together. And he brings the bright tulips into the apartment. And she's always like scattering those everywhere and descending back into the whiteness. And then at the end, there's all this coffee and it gets like broken up. So there's this like color arc that's happening that I was able to like discern that I don't think I was conscious of at all. You know, in my book that's coming out now, like I struggled with this thing for so many years because I had this like hyper passive character, utterly like subject to this like abject feminine passivity, but also kind of like exulting in the possible freedoms of it, maybe like if you're not at the center, you can be free over here. And it's actually like the secret that every woman should realize, or some fucked up thing. And I was trying to write about the first draft of that book. It was really plot driven. It had all these wacky events and all this stuff was happening. And I had to throw that all away and figure out, like, find the structure. And it took so long. And I had to think about like visual arcs and like sonic arcs and like repetition and how like, and like slight variation and all of these things that I feel like they're not talked about in like fiction education that often. And I was like discovering them for myself, but then I was reading this piece and I was like, it's already there. Yeah. Like there was like an arc and a structure, like, and I wasn't trying to like make all this stuff happen. And like, that wasn't what was instinctive to me. And it was like, later on, I was trying to like push all that in for characters it did not make sense at all for. And so there's a way in which I'm just like, wow, I actually knew something that was like, you know, appropriate to like the project that I was trying to engage in. And so I guess like, you know, if I had trusted that more, I'm sure I had to go through everything that I did, but there's a way in which like maybe the key to my novel was in this story I wrote when I was 15. Fuck.
Well, that's like a theme that happens over and over and over on this podcast. Yeah. And Josh put it really well last time. He said, it took me 20 years to get back to the things I inherently knew at 16. And it's wild to me that the core of who we want to be and the core of what we know about the art that we want to create it's there. And it's true, we need to go as far away from it as possible and pick up new skills. But I don't know, it makes me happy to think that in that 15, 16-year-old self, you already knew in like a cellular way what you were doing.
And there's a way, I think, too, it's like the fact that I was in a situation where I was forced to produce this. Like, it was like a rehearsal. It's like you like construct a series of pages and then that exists as this like fictional object and you can revisit it and like practice it anew. And, you know, probably you know what you want to say, but you also start saying something and then you try again and you do it better and you try again and you do it better. And so you might be kind of locking yourself into something, but you can at least improve.
Madeline, that's so great. And it's just incredible, as Stephen was saying, to know not only that you've been writing this whole time and from the work you were doing from high school up through college and MFA level, and then to see now you have this novel that's just about to come out from Rescue Press. Could you talk just briefly about maybe either what you're working on now or if there's anything you'd like to say about the novel?
Well, I'm going to revisit this story. Wow. Since you guys have given me so much confidence. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, come on. That's a great idea.
When I light this closet on fire, story goes with it. I can talk a little bit about what I'm working on. Yeah. Or trying to. So as we've alluded to, I was working on this one novel for a really long time. Like, I wrote a version of it, I think I started in 2009, and worked on for a couple of years and then like threw away, to my great relief, was so happy like never to have to look at that again. And then for some reason, like lugged it out and revived it a couple of years later, wrote a totally different version of it at that point, not totally, but somewhat different. And then threw that away right before the pandemic. And then that all happened. I had kids during all this time too. And then I lugged that out and revived it, around like 2023, 2022. And now it's coming out. So I finally been able to start some new work.
Yeah.
I was so stuck in that for so long. Even when I would write stories or start other things, but they didn't feel like real like projects that I was going to be invested in for very long. But I had this idea that maybe I should start a lot of things so that there would be less pressure on the one thing. Mm. So I've started not one, not two, but three books.
Yes. That's a great idea. I love that. Yeah.
And we'll see if one of them becomes more like live or absorbing than the others. But in the meantime, all it means is that I never know what to do. Like when I actually have time to write, I'm like, I don't know, what am I working on? And then like the day's over. So basically if it took me 20 years to write one book, it's going to be like 60 before my next one comes out with this new Cracker Jack plan I have.
So Madeline, do you think that that 16-year-old genius who had read everything and was obviously working at such a high level, what do you think she would think of you now? Do you think she would be, I mean, I think I know, but what do you think she would think?
I mean, do you want me to be honest?
Yeah.
I mean, she'd be like really upset.
No, that's like.
What do you mean? Why?
Well, she'd just be like, she'd be like, what, you don't have a job and you like live, you like, you're like still in a closet, like, you know,
you're still
like
in you, a closet.
What's the, what, like, why do you live in that weird town with all those wood scientists and like, what are you doing?
Yeah, but she doesn't know. She's a kid. She doesn't know.
Yeah, and like,
she doesn't know what a triumph. She doesn't know what a triumph it is to be you. And
you need to just like, you just need to rub it in her face. Like, I don't see your published work.
What she would be really, really, really happy to see, truly, is like the people that I have in my life, like you, you three, the others, Carol Pagel, you know, my old ball and chain as a writer. But I have an adult life where I have, you know, my best friends in the whole world are people who understand like the way someone else's voice inside your head can be the thing that frees you and makes you whole. And that's really incredible. So I wish I were closer to all my writer friends. But my 15-year-old self who was like dating the Sebado concert going comedian would be, and who was a lovely person, and I hope he's well, but she would be really delighted to see that like I can share something that is like, it's so secret. And like I was saying, it's like intensely social and rejecting of sociality. And so it's really special and strange and rare to be able to share it with other people practicing it and understanding like the way that logic and language operates. So it's so great to see the three of you and talk to you about it.
Oh, Madeline, you too. And when you talk about that community, I know it's something that Lauren and Steven and myself love about not only this podcast, but about the writers we get to talk with, whether they're old friends like you or new friends, folks that we've only known on the page or admired from afar. The fact that we are all in this together, I think, is what makes all of us keep going. It's what makes art possible, to know that there's always going to be another reader, another person pushing the art forward. And you've been that for me for a long time and for many of us. And we're so proud of you with the novel coming out. Can't wait to hear all the success it brings to you. And we hope to see you back here in Iowa City very soon.
We have a couch in the office. You've been on it.
I plan to spend as much time as possible there.
You could move into my office, honestly.
We'll get you back here real soon.
Sad me of the future has like really intricate visions for herself. True. So well,
Madeline, thank you
so much. I look
forward
to it.
Thank you so much for joining us on the pod. It's been amazing to have you.
Bye,
thank
Madeline.
You guys so much for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.